It's time for Almost an Hour with Henrik Stenson, presented by Callaway Golf. Henrik, I don't know if you've seen them, but the new Big Bertha line of clubs, BB21, that is out. Slice correctors. Some would call them a slice killer, but I don't think I'm legally allowed to. What's the worst slice you've ever seen in a pro-am that you would love to have had the Big Bertha 21 to hand to this particular person?
Yeah, it was a guy I played with in France, and he sliced it so badly he actually hit himself in the back. So he needs to get one of these clubs, that's for sure.
All right, well, Mr. Slice in the back, if you're around, direct message Henrik on social media and we will get you a Big Bertha 21. That sounds crazy. I would have loved to have seen that. All right, we got a lot to cover today. We're going to talk about DJ, going to talk about the U.S. Open. We're going to, of course, answer Ask the Iceman. Your dogs are very excited about Ask the Iceman. I can hear them excited for that session.
I don't know what's going on here. I think the alarm on the car went off and the neighbor's dog that are visiting went crazy. So give me 30 seconds then and we'll try and calm this situation down.
All right. We'll take 30 seconds and let you calm the situation down and then give us a full report on it.
It should be all be good.
All right. Well, the rough streets of Lake Nona strike again. Let's get to someone else who was hot last week. DJ, 30 under par. I mean, come on, 30 under par? How impressive is that?
Well, it's not that hard. He played six rounds, didn't he?
No, he did not. I mean, it's not. Look, if you're trying to rank accomplishments,
it's actually pretty good 62. To play 30 under on six rounds, too, though. So that was actually not even a good joke on my end. But he.
But 62 pars versus 30 under par? I mean, 62 pars is a heck of a lot more consistent than 30 under par.
Let's leave the 62 pars now. I don't want to hear about them anymore. I'd rather go for 30 under par, I have to say. Very impressive performance. From what I saw on TV, obviously the golf course was favorable in the sense that it was playing fairly bouncy, it looked like, off the tee. It looked like it was giving out some generous distance off the tee, and if you're DJ, you obviously hit it a very long way to start with. But it seemed to be fairly firm fairways and receptive greens, which is obviously one factor that can set you up. But like we always said, no matter how easy a golf course is or how easy the conditions are, you still have to perform and you still have to do it. So even if you're playing a chip and putt golf course, 30 under is amazing. So, a fantastic performance. And, I mean, to lap the field that way, I think he won by 11 in the end, right? So, to keep on going and deliver that result, that was not really anything short of Tiger-esque from U.S. Open Pebble Beach 2000. I mean, to just keep on going and leave everyone in dust like that.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing to me was on that 60 on that round, he didn't make a birdie after the 11th hole.
That one I did see. I had a friend of mine texting me. I was back in Sweden, and he texted me. He's like, DJ just made another birdie. He's 11 under through 11. So I turned the TV on, and an hour and a half later, I texted my friend, that was your making. You jinxed him. You did this to DJ, and he's not going to be happy with you. So, thanks to one of my friends, Magnus, back in Sweden, it was his fault, really. He put the lid on that 58 or 59 or whatever it could have been.
Yeah, I mean, that could have been, the first 57 or even lower in PGA Tour history. Do you think, Justin Thomas said this week, we're going to get a 55, 56, 57 at some point. Do you think that's realistic? Do you think we're going to see that?
Yeah, when the conditions are favorable and the guys are playing really well. I mean, it was just crazy that Scotty shot a 59 earlier, and you're sitting in the clubhouse, and at one point he wasn't the only one thinking that this might not even be the lowest score of the day. So the competition is getting better and better, scores are getting lower, and I wouldn't be surprised to see a 57 or a 58 in the near future.
I know you're a huge fan of Gil Hanft's design, and we'll get to him a little bit because he's the one who retouched Wingfoot up. But that golf course just seemed like it was almost the perfect storm, where it was just the conditions were prime for scoring. What about mentally when you're going super low like that? Because you may find this hard to believe, Henrik, but a lot of us can't relate to this. What's the mental challenge when you get to that point when you're really far under par and you're thinking like, wow, I could make some history? Or do you not think that? Can you legitimately stay shot by shot?
It depends. It's very much individual how you all function and so on, and how you think and process that in those situations. But one thing is for sure, it will catch up with you at some point, you know, and it takes away the focus from what you're doing, and you start thinking about what could happen. And that's always the challenge in this game and in a lot of other things that we do, to stay present and keep on doing what you're doing and not thinking about the outcome and what's happened and what might happen. So that is the challenge. And if you want to shoot that lowest number that you can, you got to be on top of those things and really stay in the present. So that's the challenge. The best one would be to ask DJ if he at any point there on the back nine, it started catching up with him, and he could feel his focus change from one shot at a time to possibly thinking about the outcome. But I watched it. Obviously, it would have been great to see another 59 there, and I saw some comments where someone said, "Well, it's probably one of the few times or the one time someone walks off a golf course disappointed shooting 60," and people watching kind of felt the same way. So at the end of the day, it's about winning the tournament, and he certainly did that. But it would have been, I'm sure, that extra icing on the cake to shoot a 59 or 58 or even lower on that round.
All right, I have something I kind of want to say, but I better not. Let's transition here to the playoffs as a FedEx Cup champion. And I've always wanted this. Like, I don't know why you don't always have a shirt on that says something that you won. Like, if I ever won anything, I'd be wearing it every day. Like, you know, I am the Open champion, and don't forget, I won the FedEx. Maybe that's the difference between us. But where do you rank winning the FedEx Cup championship in the accomplishments?
No, it's certainly up there. I think I'm always going to hold the Claire Jug as the ultimate achievement in my career. But the FedEx Cup and the golf I played in 2013, 5 or 6 months, I was virtually on top of my game and won both the overall in the US and on the European Tour and those tour championships, both the race to Dubai final and the tour championship. And it was a great run, and especially fending off Tiger like I did. He was number one when we came into East Lake. I was number two, and we paired up in the first round, and I think I shot a bogey free 6 under par in the first round and beat Tiger by 6 or 7 shots, I think. So it was a great performance on my end at East Lake. And you winning the FedEx Cup, you got to prove yourself over and over. You're getting into the playoffs. I was I think I was in ninth position when it started, so I was very, very much in the running in 2013 there when we started it. But you still got to perform throughout the first number of tournaments, and once you get to East Lake, you can be ahead or slightly behind and be in a good position when you start the week, but you still got to do it all over again. So it's a long road from when the season starts until you're standing there as the crown champion. So it's a great achievement and something I'm very proud of.
And in terms of, you know, the money, I know we don't always like to talk about money, but it's different when it comes to these, whether it's the race to Dubai or the FedEx Cup championships. There's a lot of extra bonus money, more than just winning the individual tournament on the line. Does that affect players? Is it different? Is it noticed? Is it thought about? Or is it just like the goal is to win, and then what comes with the win is sort of different?
I think that depends on, again, I mean, it could depend on the focus. I know some players, they play for winning the tournaments and get the most satisfaction out of the achievements and the trophies. The money part, the financial part, it's always going to be a nice bonus when you're being paid to do what you love to do the most. But on the other end, I know some guys who tend to be a little bit more focused on the financial benefits and playing for the cash. And I could potentially see that as being more of a problem if you're more focused on the money side when there's a big money prize on the line. So I think it can be a bit individual, but I think anyone would certainly feel you're walking up to that tee on Sunday and you're knowing it's $10 million for the first prize or $15 million rather than $1.5 million. It's going to be a big difference at the end of the day. So I'm sure that will affect players. The more accomplished you are, and possibly the more zeros there are on your personal bank account, the less importance will that play in. So it's kind of hard to give an answer straight across the board, but I find that it certainly gets your attention. But at the end of the day, for me personally, it was about beating the best players in the world and getting my name on the trophy. So I think I managed to put that aside, and that's a really nice added bonus afterwards. That it was a boatload of money coming along with this too.
I remember when Snedeker won, that he said he woke up early in the morning and kept hitting refresh to wait for the transfer to go in. Because the big check, people don't realize this, the big check you actually don't deposit in your account. That's kind of just more for show. People don't realize that. But, I remember Snedeker saying he literally sat there at like whatever time in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock, refresh, 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 refresh. It's kind of a cool moment. I would do that.
Yeah, and it changed. I mean, like I said there, now I don't even know. Is it 15 million to the winner? Is it 10?
I don't even know.
We probably should know. It used to be 10, but I have a feeling that it got bumped up to 15. It did get
bumped up with the new contract. So you know
I have to say that's the benefit on my end, not having made it to Eastlake. I don't have to worry about that nor last year or this year. So I'll cross that bridge when I get there.
15 million for the winner. Out of 70 million player bonus, the runner up gets 5 million, which is, you know, that's not a bad spot to be in either. I would take a runner up finish. All right. Speaking of someone who looks like they're on the way to winning, and we're recording this on a Wednesday morning and there's some weather in Missouri. So they're out playing, and I am staring at my computer, which is showing me the Champions Tour leaderboard. And at this point, Phil Mickelson on the fourth hole drove a par 4 to 15 feet and then made the eagle. He's currently five ahead of his nearest competitor, 4 under on his round through 5 holes. What do you think about Phil on the Champions Tour, looking like he's on the way to victory in start one?
Yeah, he's obviously playing great. He would join a pretty big club now, right? Of players mm-hmm. who made the transition of winning the first.
Yeah, we just saw Jim Furyk do it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I remember him and us that we discussed in a previous pod here. Win a couple of years back and along with a bunch of others. So I think it's you're coming from the very competitive environment out on the PGA Tour, and all of a sudden the golf course is going to be set up quite a lot shorter, I would imagine, and you feel like you can reach the par fives with comfortable irons, maybe on the second shot. And I mean, don't forget, Phil is long as well. I mean, I saw something there that he hit a 340 yard tee shot or something. And I mean, most courses are going to feel fairly short if you got that kind of firepower from the tee box. So you're just feeling like it's a nice, easy setup, and you're used to playing against stronger fields, and it probably feels a lot easier. So it's going to be an impressive first win here, straight out of the blocks. And the question afterwards is he going to play more on the Champions Tour, or is this a one-off? I remember I spoke to him. It was probably a year ago, and at that point, my impression was that he wasn't going to play a lot on the Champions Tour. He wanted to keep on playing on the PGA Tour for quite some while, quite some time. So we'll just have to see what the case is.
Yeah, I apologize. It was a fifth hole. He drove 352-yard par 4-5, drove the green to 15 feet and drained the eagle putt. You know, I think this was a perfect storm for Phil to play on the Champions Tour. He did feel he was playing well. He missed the cut in Boston. Has been playing a ton of golf out in San Diego and says he's been playing great and doesn't want to go into the U.S. Open not having played a lot of tournament rounds, which that leads me to going into the U.S. Open without playing a lot of tournament rounds. How's that going to work out?
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. My plan is I'm going to be home here in Florida for the next 2.5 weeks, prepare for the U.S. Open. Golf course has been shut now for a couple of days, so... Haven't really practiced anything as of yet, but looking to get on a good schedule here for the next 2.5 weeks and get ready. Final week before I leave, I'll play a lot of golf, play a lot of rounds to try and get into tournament mode as much as possible without playing tournament.
All right, so I have a couple questions about that. First, while your golf course is closed, you know, you do have an offer to come practice somewhere else, just for the record.
Thank you.
No problem. Second, when you practice and you're trying to get ready for a U.S. Open, will you play 18 holes a day? Will you play 18 holes in practice? Will you walk? Will you ride? Can you kind of walk everyone through kind of what your mini training camp is? This is a big time of year for NFL training camp. What's your training camp going to be like?
Yeah, as of now, I'm doing some gym work. I'm going to start playing, you know, just hitting shots and putting and all the bits and pieces. And then as I go along, I will face off a little bit from the physical training and the kind of technical training and get more into just playing golf and it'd be playing 9 holes, playing 18 holes. Whatever I feel like it's needed for the moment. And I'll still ride in my cart. I mean, I feel like I'm very much in the physical shape where it's not going to be an issue to go out and walk the golf course at Wingfoot. Okay. So with the heat that we have in Florida at this time of the year, I think it's better spent energy wise to ride in the cart when I'm practicing and reserve that energy for more practice afterwards.
Okay. And I know we talked about it a couple podcasts ago. You did mention you're up 0.5 pound in your weight as you're chasing distance like Bryson. Any update with this extra gym work? Are you up maybe 0.75 pound or are you still kind of hovering at that 0.5 pound gain?
I think we still might be at the 0.5 pound. I have a new theory though. It's kind of a slogan that I give up 40 yards off the tee, but I gained 50 on the conditioning side. I don't know if that's going to work out, but that's kind of what we're working towards.
Okay, let's get some hats, t-shirts, and stuff. And then I would be remiss to ask you, Phil, donning these amazing sunglasses yet again, but there's only one person who's kind of the mogul of sunglasses in pro golf, and that's you. Henrik Stenson, Eyewear US, right? The website we break every time we mention it, even though I probably say the wrong website every time. Can you give me your thoughts on
I think Phil you shades? Got it right this time. Okay, I think good. We definitely need to send Phil some shades.
Yeah, let's do that.
I'm not sure if he's rocking it as the model he could be at the moment.
Okay, I've heard he likes lightweight. I heard that's the key. So let's make sure we get him the titanium ones that
we can do lightweights. We've got a couple of options for him.
All right, back to the U.S. Open, because we can't always talk about sunglasses. But if you do want to learn more about sunglasses, Henrik Stenson and I were U.S. Tiger and JT just did a little scouting trip on the way up to Boston. Is that something you do? Is that something you don't do? Is that something you think is valuable? Is it not valuable? Talk me through that.
Yeah, but it's not really going to work out to do the scouting trip when I'm actually going to the events. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, I mean, but you can fly there today.
On a serious note, looking back at say the Open Championship, I've had in the plan for most times to go to the Open venue. I walk it on the Sunday afternoon, and then on the Monday I would play 18 holes, kind of with the reflections that I made and the game plan that I made the day before, and then I go and play the Scottish Open on a links course, get into the kind of thinking and playing links, and then when I come back then to the Open Championship, I've already seen the golf course twice. I can take the Monday off if it's been a tiring week at the Scottish. Sometimes you get tough weather at the links events and so on. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, I would play the front nine and the back nine each of those 2 days. So I only do really 9 and 9 at the venue. But I still feel like I've been around the golf course a full 3 rounds. And that has worked out really well. So that's been something I've tried to do and have done for some of the other major championships as well. But now with everything here, it's been a different year, and as such some of the approaches have been a little bit different as well. I was down to go through New York and play winged foot on my way back to Sweden in May to have seen the golf course and played it once more before coming back there, but that didn't happen. So we'll just kind of take it as it comes a little bit more this time around. But I have been to winged foot before. I played my first US Open there in 06 when Jeff Ogilvy won over Phil and Colin Montgomery. I've been back on one or two outings as well. And as I mentioned to you earlier, I was at the 10th hole and probably played that 18 or 20 times. So I should be an expert on the 10th hole, par 3 there. So I'm looking forward to that one again.
So will you try to get up there maybe the Sunday before to get a little walk in or a round in, do you think?
No, I'm just I think I'm just going to be there on the Monday, mid morning on the Monday, and have the 2.5 days to get used to the conditions that we're going to see. And if there's one thing that's as a plus with us playing with no crowds and no other people really around, is you can be more effective. You don't lose as much time and energy on other things. So it's easier to prepare and be getting the work in that you want to do before the event starts. So there's always a positive, however small, in this bigger negative. So I guess in terms of preparation, we can be using our time a little bit better with not so many people around.
I feel like that was directed at me, because I've seen you at some of the last couple of US Opens on the range, and I've tried to be, you know, very just a 2 second quick high while you're doing stuff, but maybe that 2 seconds impacted your ability
to win that championship. Trim that down to maybe one in the future?
I'll do my best. All right. One last thing. Some of the schedule kind of is starting to get announced. Lots of events are doing schedule. F1 just announced 4 new events. But the PGA Tour, kind of people have been wondering, they've traditionally played some of the fall events over in Japan, Korea, in Asia. And we saw that one of the events so far has been announced that it's moving to Shadow Creek in Las Vegas, site of the original match between Phil and Tiger. MGM does a big outing there every year. Now we have a little 2 week Vegas swing. Any thoughts on Shadow? I don't know if you've ever been there, but any thoughts on having this little 2 week Vegas swing? And is there a chance to see the Iceman in Las Vegas?
Well, first I want to thank you for clarifying that Korea and Japan are in Asia. I think that's very helpful.
All about geography here. School's back, you know, to virtual here. I'm just trying to make sure everybody's following along with us.
Yeah, no, when I make my schedule, it'd be great if you could be involved in the future and fill me in on those important issues. I think it's obviously a different year, and again, things are going to change, schedule's going to change, and I think it's great to see an event like the CJ Cup then be moved to Vegas. It's 2 weeks back to back in Vegas. For me personally, I'd love to play. I hope the organizers of the CJ Cup is listening to this podcast. How could they not? And sure they are. I would love to get a spot in the field, because with me not playing much golf so far this year and in no position to make it on my own, I would need an invite to get into the limited field. So if okay. they're listening, I'd love to come play. I'd love to be in Vegas for the 2 weeks, and we'll see if we can make that happen.
All right. I will personally make a couple phone calls after we're done recording this, and I'm sure that will not help one bit. What will help is getting to Ask the Iceman, where we use your, Henrik, social media channels, which are really putting out some good content. I laughed pretty hard at some of the video I think you put out on Monday. To ask,
that's probably because you weren't involved in the production of that. Do you think that could have anything to do with it, or?
It does make it funnier. It does make it funnier when I'm not involved. Good. I love when you do stuff with the European tour. Those are my favorite things you do. But the best part about Ask the Iceman is if your question is selected, you get a free t-shirt. Have you gotten yours yet, Henrik?
Nope. Still waiting for
Neither
mine.
Neither okay.
Hey, we'll see.
Lex, I don't even think Lex got hers yet. So we'll work on this. But here's our first question from James Thompson. I'm just curious on your preparation for the majors and the Ryder Cup events. Well, James, good thing we just covered some of that. And how much it differs from a regular tour stop. And have you ever gone into a major without your A game?
Yeah, well, I would say, I guess I've only gone into one major with my A game.
Which one was that?
I don't know. Okay. No, it's... I mean, it's hard. I think in golf, we gotta over time we try and figure out the best way for us to be able to peak at the time that we want to. And I think in some other sports where it's probably more down to the physical training, the hard training that you need to do, you have a schedule that's a little bit easier to follow. It seems to be. Mm-hmm. Seems to be harder in golf and some other sports to actually peak at the time that you want to. Because if you're talking on the physical side, there's time when you're going to do the heavy training, you break yourself down, and then you kind of, you know, have different phases of building yourself up to be in peak performance at the right time. Here, it's so many different parts in the game and mentally more than anything. So I think it's probably more the mental peaking that's the important, that you rested, that your mind's in the right place and you prepared well for that week and you're coming in pretty happy about most things. But if I look back at my career, having won roughly 20 pretty big tournaments around the world, I couldn't tell you that I felt like I've had my A game in for all of those. A lot of them, I think I've just been fairly happy with most parts of my game. And I think that was the same for the Open Championship win in 2016. I was just, you know, in a good place with myself mentally, physically, and golf-wise. Most of the parts of my game were in a good spot. And then it just, for whatever reason, came together that week. Is that mentally? Is it because your technique is good? Is a combination of everything? It's really hard to know. So I think you can just really try and give yourself the best circumstances and best chances of performing well at any given week. Then when we play so much, not this year, but normally we play anything from low 20s up to 30 tournaments, you can't have a 2 week or 3 week planning and preparation time for each one of the events. So you're going to play a lot of tournaments that are, I mean, I'm not sure if labeling them practice tournaments would be the right way to say it, but you have a major or a couple of big events where you want to try and be in the best possible shape. And then you play in tournaments to get receipts on and to get answers on where you stand with your game and what you need to try and make better for the weeks ahead and so on. So you certainly try and perform your best and you want to win every time you tee it up, but there's certainly some tournaments that you play and they're more there as a prep work and as a tournament to give you the answers where you stand and how to become better for the bigger tournaments. I think I pretty much said it myself that it's being ready mentally and feeling refreshed and all that, because there's a lot of patience at major championships and if you're kind of on the edge with your energy levels and everything else, chances are you're not going to be able to be that resilient and stand up against the blows that you're going to take throughout the week.
Be a great marketing slogan. Tune in this week. It's a prep week.
Yeah, we'll make a t-shirt with that too, right?
We probably wouldn't get them. All right, Christine Holmes, who also has a t-shirt coming. 18-hole tournament rounds can be so long sometimes. Any tips on how to stay focused and sharp throughout? Thanks.
Yeah, I think two key things that comes to mind for me. One is to make sure that you drink enough fluids throughout the round. You eat enough so you have energy throughout the whole day and the whole round. Because if you're out there for 5 hours plus the before warm-ups and the rest of it, you gotta stay energized and hydrated, that's for sure. Especially the harder places we play, that's key, and that goes for amateur golfers as well. So that's one thing. And in terms of the focus, no one can stay focused for 5 hours straight. So the key part is really switching on your focus and your concentration, and then after you hit the shot, then you get out of concentration, because you can't stay for the whole round and the whole day concentrated. You're just going to burn out mentally on that. So it's really finding that kind of in and out and switching on and off on your concentration. That's going to be a key thing. There's certainly different techniques and tips that one can find and to try and make that, but just for me personally, when I've hit a shot, when the ball's in the air and when it's landed and everything's done there, then I speak to my caddy, I speak to my playing partners, and then you get that quite naturally, that you go in and out of concentration, and then when we approach the ball and we're getting yardages and so on, then it's game time again, and we go into the bubble and do our thing, and yeah, so on and off on the concentration is going to be key.
What do you eat during a round?
I eat some gluten-free bars that I have, normally two of those around, maybe a banana, sometimes a protein shake. And it depends also on if it's a morning round or afternoon round and what I've put in the system before and how closely to the warm up that I've eaten as well. But it's normally a couple of bars and some fruits and some nuts, and then I mix water and a hydration drink as well. And the harder and the more you sweat, the more important it is to make sure you get some salts and electrolytes and that back in the system again.
No hot dog at the turn?
Negative. So that's for the odd social round.
Okay. All right. Next one. Rocky Downing. Great name, Rocky Downing. Who's your favorite player to needle or trash talk? And then follow up, who gives it back to you the best?
Yeah, there's a couple of guys who like to do that. I mean, there's a lot of kind of banter going around on tour and maybe not so much when we're playing competitive rounds. But it's always, if there's a little money game in a practice round or something, there'll be plenty of banter and trash talking going around. I mean, I've had some fun moments with Phil, with Tiger over the years. So I think Kevin Kistner is a fun dude.
He's
a fierce competitor, and he likes to talk smack as well. So I'd mention them three to start with then.
All right, I like that. And those are our Ask the Iceman questions for this week. Again, go to Henrik's channels, ask your question, and you can win an Ask the Iceman t-shirt. All right, Henrik, it's video time. And this video you selected and sent to me, it's titled, this is where I love it. You thought I was master of the obvious with my geography lesson earlier. It's called Golfer Jumps in Ponds. So why don't you hit play, Lex, and guess what this golfer does?
yeah, it's a good one. So he's obviously
his golf ball clearly lands in a mud bank.
Yeah,
but it's up.
Is in a what's now called the penalty area, right? But it's
correct.
It's a water hazard.
Yellow staked penalty area.
Yeah, and he jumps out there to play it, and when he comes flying in there, he gets up like almost waist high in this mud, at least thigh high.
What do you think? What do you think he was playing for? I mean, like, there had to be some pretty significant. And then this is the worst part: is he just picks the ball up?
Well,
which makes no sense.
If you listen to the sound later, when he jumps out, he thinks it's his ball, but then when he gets out, they realize it's actually not his ball that's laying there.
Yeah, yeah, so, it's just absolutely great. And then I love his dismount strategy here. Right? I mean, I don't know what you do at this point. Like, you've already made it. You've already made it worse. But here's the question. Like, I mean, you know, at least he can swim. But why wouldn't he put his rain pants on? Why doesn't he have rain pants? This is why you bring rain pants to the golf course.
Yeah, but I didn't have any in the rally either. So it's
but it wasn't going to rain that day.
No, he probably didn't think it was going to rain either. But you know, like I said, there's always a negative in the or a positive.
Positive in the negative. What's the positive in that?
He picked up like three or four golf balls out there.
He did.
They were pristine, and they were your used ones.
Yeah, of course they were. You know, it's funny. I hit it more to the right than to the left. But actually,
that point was on the right hand side.
Good point. I hit a lot to the left the other day, but no one wants to hear about my golf game. But we do want to hear about some architecture. Your courses, especially your one in Sweden, just keeps getting critically acclaimed and great reviews. Next time you're in Sweden, go play it. I would give the website, but I'm sure I'll screw that up too. But Wingfoot, classic Parkland golf course. Obviously, there's so many golf courses in that general, you know, New York, New Jersey, the what we call the kind of metropolitan area there. What makes Wingfoot great compared to, you know, other Parkland courses there? You know, Justin Thomas said the other day, it's one of his favorite courses after playing it one of the first times, just straight in front of you, tons of rough, really challenging greens. What do you think makes it great from an architectural point of view?
Well, I kind of like the straight there in front of you. I mean, I like to see, visually, I like that. I want to see where I'm going. And you certainly do that, at Wingfoot. The feeling of the property with the big oaks, the big trees, that you can't really go wrong with that. And that's always the hard thing. If you build a new golf course, depending on what piece of property you have, it's hard to compete with something that's been there for 60 years or 100 years or however long it's been there. So, it's a nice property, big trees, like I said, challenging greens, from what I recall. It's been a while since I played it, but I certainly recall a few of them being kind of semi elevated and quite undulated. So it's got the rubber stamp of the old kind of classic championship golf courses within the Parkland. How do you say?
Genre.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You took that out of my
mouth. You can't compare it to Lynx golf or anything like that. What I love about it is, you know, amazing clubhouse. You know, you kind of pull up and you know you're at some place that's kind of neat. You know, old school locker room with kind of that metal where you can kind of see through in the lockers. You can see what's in other people's lockers. That's always kind of fun. But you know, when you think about just kind of some of the great holes there. And especially, you know, for me, I think the par threes, when you said you spent an entire day on 10, you know, par threes there, pretty cool. And then 18 is certainly a worthy 72nd hole of a major championship. I do think it'll be interesting to see how it plays in the fall. Hopefully we'll get some good weather for you guys, kind of see how that kind of all breaks down. But I do think that, you know, with Parkland golf courses, in terms of kind of the framing of the trees, as someone who does architecture, how do you, when you look at a property, when you see trees or when you see hills or undulations that are there before the golf course is designed, how does that impact kind of the routing that, that you want to put together?
Yeah, I think you want to lay the course out in the in nature in the land as much as you can, and not I mean, you can modify a lot of things these days with all the equipment and everything else that we have available to us, but I'd prefer to try and be as least intrusive as you need to be, and kind of work with what you have, and especially when it comes to trees. I mean, it takes a long time for a big, beautiful tree to grow up. So, I certainly wouldn't go in there with a chainsaw and start taking trees out before I know that they really have to go, or if they can't add anything to the course and the holes where they're situated. So, I'd definitely take more of a gentle approach on that. Then, I mean, it's everyone likes different things, I like big trees as long as I don't have to hit into them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you hit the ball so good, you could just hit over them or around them or even under them. In some cases, under the branches, I'm sure.
I just use my tree wood.
Your tree wood. Oh, I see what you did there. Wow,
we're not going to be hosting
a comedy. It did have to be done. It'll be interesting to see, since the last time you were there, Gil Hance touched up Wingfoot, kind of restored some of the green complexes back to sort of their original shape and undulation. So we'll be able to see how that plays out. I look forward to it in a couple weeks. What I also look forward to every week on this podcast is a great tour story. Last time we roasted Ian Poulter a little bit. I demanded, because I'm pretty... pretty tough on you with these podcast preparation, just like you are with your own personal major championship preparation. I wanted a FedEx Cup story. So give me a good FedEx Cup tour story.
Yeah, I had to think a little bit, and I came up with one that's quite funny. It involves myself, and we're back in 2013. So I just won at TPC Boston. I'm leading the FedEx Cup. We're playing the third event. So back then it was actually four playoff events. Yeah. Now we're down to three. Mm-hmm. So we're into the third one. I'm playing at, or we are playing at Conway Farms, outskirts of Chicago. I'm doing okay. Nothing great, but I'm around 20th, I think. And I'm on the 71st hole, par three down the hill, 6 iron or 7 iron yardage. And it's quite a shallow green. The pin is up on the right-hand side over a bunker. And I just take dead aim, hit a beautiful shot straight at the pin. And it comes up a good 12 yards short in the bunker and the rough just short of the bunker. And I look at my caddy and he looks at me, and neither one of us understands anything. And then, you know, walking down, and I might have mentioned to him, as you would, are you sure the yardage was right? And he starts looking in his book and back and forth. And I had no chance for an up and down really where I was. So I made the four and walking over to the next tee box. And Gareth, he says, well, I think I got it wrong on the sprinkler there. So, you know, we were 8 yards out or something on the number. So that kind of explains why, because I had a perfect shot. I mean, I was happy with it. He was happy with it. And we just couldn't work out why. So he says that he was 8 yards out, and that kind of explains it. So obviously that didn't put me in a better mood, because now I'm a little upset with him. And he's made a mistake, and that's cost us a shot and so on. So I guess I can't really control my own emotions there. So I'm a little upset when I'm walking up and making the pass on the last hole with the driver, and I hit it left in the water on this par five. And as we're walking up to take a drop, Gareth comes to the wonderful conclusion that he wasn't wrong on the previous hole. He had the perfect yardage, and it wasn't his fault at all why we came up 10 or 12 yards short on this par three. So now I'm even more angry, because now I've thought he made a mistake on the 17th, which upset me, and now I didn't control my emotions, and I made a bad mistake on 18 off the tee because I was angry from the previous hole, and that's now costing me even more. And it wasn't a mistake on this. Yeah, so you know what I'm saying? He kind of messed up without messing up.
Yeah.
And if you go on YouTube, you can see that I then smack my driver into the ground when I'm making the drop, and the head comes flying off, and we finished with not a bogey, and I was in a bad mood. And I guess the moral of the story, don't get angry.
Don't get angry, if that's the one takeaway. But the one question I have on a par three, I mean, isn't there a big old sign that tells you how far it is?
Yeah, but you know, you got the up and the down, and
I know,
and the sprinkler heads and parts of the green and so on. But yeah, there should be a sign. Jeff says it's 192 yards. You should hit six iron, and it shouldn't come up to 12 yards short.
Well, it may not be a six iron. I mean, 192 for me would be a little longer than a six iron. But at least if they gave you the proper yardage every day, why are we trying to make this tricky?
Yeah, that's, I guess that's part of it. But in the big and the small here, I guess sometimes when we see someone being upset about something or losing their head or whatever, I guess all I was trying to say that there was more behind it than maybe just hitting a tee shot left in the water and taking a drop, and then I kind of lost my temper and hit the club in the ground and the head came flying off. And yeah, that obviously doesn't look so good, but it was more to it. It was a story behind the story.
Yeah. Well, I like that. And that's also why I won't ever caddy for you.
No, because
it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, and if I hit you in the ground and the head comes flying off, that'd be horrible.
Well, it'd be really, really, really awkward for me for the rest of my life. All right, we're going to wrap this thing up with a couple quick points. Mental game. Kind of a theme. How do you get sharp without tons of tournament golf? You sort of told us with you're going through your mini training camp for the next 2 weeks. But is there anything else that you would advise to maybe amateurs who have jobs and have, you know, whether it's members coming up or just, you know, round of golf that's important to them? How do you recommend that they stay sharp when they're not able to play a lot? Like, do you go to warm up early on those first day back? What would you recommend?
Yeah, I would never really recommend changing your shoes in the boots at the parking lot and running up to the first tee if you want to try and perform. Okay. So,
excellent.
Yeah, give yourself a little bit of extra time, you know, and the two areas I would say on the range, yeah, try and find the tempo, try and find the strike, and yeah, spend a little bit extra time on that, and then it would be for putting. Make speed of the greens is probably the most important thing. Then, if you're gonna go out there and play 18 holes and you want to perform, make sure you spend a good 20-30 minutes on the putting green, picking up the pace of the greens, because avoiding three putts. And I'd say also if you find the pace for your putting, you'll also have it when you're going to chip and pitch onto the green, because you kind of know how much the ball is going to run out and so on. So preparation is always going to be important for us. It's days and weeks. And for the weekend golfer, it might be that extra 20 minutes, 30 minutes instead of just showing up at the tee box. So, yeah, that's, I guess, the most simple advice I can give.
I like it. That totally makes sense to me. This day in obscure Henrik Stenson history, I think it's actually, I think I'm looking in the future. When does virtual school start for the Stenson family?
Well, we have a little bit of a different setup this time around. So our youngest, Alice, she just started kindergarten, but we choose for her to go back to school or to start school. I felt that she's never been in that environment, even though it's a bit of a different one these days, wearing a mask at school and so on. She needs to go and still see some other kids and get the feel of what it is to go to school. My two older ones, they started on a different program with a teacher, and they're doing some education at her place, and then some days a week at home on their own. So they're in a bit of a combo program at the moment, but they started a few days ago.
Okay, well, I've heard, and this may or may not be true, but I've heard that you are an extreme disciplinarian when it comes to the virtual schooling, and that you are also going to be doing some of the teaching yourself. Can you confirm or sort of deny this?
I have to deny and confirm everything you say.
Okay, excellent. Well, good news is our This Day in Henrik Stenson History in 2 weeks will probably be about the Friday weekend review for the children that you're putting them through to make sure that they're getting the education they deserve. I'm excited for this.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm also excited for the parent-teacher conference with yourself. That'll be a pretty
could be a quick one.
All right. Well, Henrik, we will be back in 2 weeks. That will be after the Tour Championship. I would like to maybe get the FedEx Cup trophy to make an appearance in the show. So maybe we'll try to pull it out and have it ready. Even though it's an audio show, but at least for a couple of us, it's a video show. We'll be able to do that. I also think we're going to have a giveaway on that show. You don't know this yet, but we're going to be giving away, I believe, a 3-wood. So we're going to figure out between now and then. It's going to involve listening to that next episode and then reviewing, rating the episode, because we love everyone to rate and review the episode. Tell us what we're doing wrong, what you'd like to see us do better. Tell us if you've got your T-shirts for those who've asked questions and that they've actually enjoyed them.
Yeah, that sounds good. I mean, I'd much rather give away the 3-wood than the FedEx Cup trophy. So, yeah, I'm all for it.
You know what else we could give away?
You?
A 3-wood.
Absolutely. Let's give away a 3-wood and a 3-wood.
All right. Excellent. Good job with that one, Lex. Thanks, everybody, for listening. That was Almost an Hour with Henrik Stenson. Literally, we almost got to an hour. We're getting closer and closer. We will see you in 2 weeks with the next episode.
We will indeed. Thanks for listening.